hello there, football fans, and welcome to Thursday Soccer Central podcast. James Sharman here alongside John Molinaro. My apologies for Monday's podcast being cancelled at late notice. My voice was gone on Monday. Today it's there, kind of. We'll see how it lasts over the course of the next 45 minutes.
You look like an ad for death.
I'm not feeling at my best. But I'm a trooper and I came in on this Thursday.
What about me? I'm sitting here next to you.
Oh, no, you're done. You're done for. Like, this time next week, you'll be in bed. Like,
yeah, beautiful. And
on your vacation, too.
Yeah, beautiful.
I'm going to ruin it for you.
Oh, thanks, James.
You're going to have like a fever of 101 and, you know, every joint aching, awful cough and no voice.
Excellent.
Yep, excellent. All right, later in today's show, we're going to talk some Champions League football with Bobby the Brains McMahon. But as you all know, the MLS season came to its conclusion this past weekend. Portland are your champions in what was an entertaining final, I think is a word to use. Not a great final, not a wonderful quality of football, but certainly it was fun to watch. We're joined by Sportsnet's very own Paul Dolan. Paul, it's over with.
It's a long season, isn't it?
It sure is. It is.
I mean, I love it. Anyone who likes soccer wants to see it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, but I think they could condense the schedule a little bit and have that little bit much more impact towards the end, even possibly talk about the final being before that last FIFA break. And I think that might make it just a bit more condensed. You still get all the excitement of all the games and everything else, but it was a good season. And like you said there, John, or James, sorry.
That's all right. I've been called worse. I love it.
You know, it wasn't a classic final in terms of quality of play, but it was fun to watch. That's why we watch the games, in my opinion anyway. And I think there's been a little bit too much said about maybe the quality not being there, because I think people who watched the game enjoyed it.
Paul, what did you make of, I know we've touched on this before, you know, the crowd in Columbus, because, you know, it's in recent years that the league has moved it to from a neutral site to, you know, a home team, whoever has the better home record in the final hosting it. Do you like that concept?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's the way to go. I think it rewards the teams that do better in the regular season. We've already talked quite a bit about the MLS playoff structure, and people have said that, you know, they think that maybe a neutral site is the better way to go. You can advertise the game and promote it a little bit further. And, you know, I've been to a game where, actually it was in Columbus in 2001, where it was a neutral site game, and you had San Jose and Los Angeles, two teams that, you know, weren't even close to Columbus, and it was difficult to sell that game. It wasn't even a full stadium, and there just wasn't the atmosphere. It was a very corporate-type atmosphere. And so I think having, first of all, the reward for doing well in the regular season, putting more importance on the regular season, and then having that type of atmosphere. Now, in saying that, Caleb Porter noted that he thought that the better ambience was coming from the Timbers Army, which was only, you know, a couple of thousand strong versus the other 19,000 that were supposed to be Columbus Crew supporters. So not sure that you want to have Portland as the team that's traveling to your championship game when you're playing in the final, but all credit to the Timbers Army as well, who travel so well.
A few goalkeeping errors in that game from both sides, especially in that opening minute. I mean, that was just horrendous. As a former goalkeeper, interested to hear your take on
keep it clean.
Yeah, keep it clean on how you thought the two goalkeepers performed.
I think they're both pretty good goalkeepers. I've talked to Pat Onstad about his goalkeeper there, Steve Clark. And obviously seen Adam Quaresi quite a bit here up in Vancouver too, and he's been with the Timbers. And I think they've had pretty good seasons. Quaresi tied for the league lead in terms of clean sheets with David Osted. I don't think he's a fantastic keeper, and obviously he was at fault, I think, at the goal that he conceded, not really being confident in his punch. I think he probably right. Could have even caught it. I think he was a little unlucky when he went to ground, and then he was about to corral it, and Kai Kamara did a good job of kicking it away from him there. But the one that Steve Clark concedes, that's a tough one for me. Mistakes like that do happen, there's no question, but it's almost as if he was too calm, too casual, and didn't want the event or the occasion to overwhelm him. But he took too much time. And
he really dawdled on the ball, didn't he?
He did, and you've got to credit to the Timbers, who knew that.
Oh, absolutely.
They know that he likes to play on the ball. They wanted to pressure high dictate the tempo themselves right from the start. Diego Valeri does a fantastic job, but Steve Clarke, in the first minute of the game, in the championship final at home, needs to do a better job of just being safety first. And then, you know, if he wants to play on the ball a little bit later in the game when he's got more confidence and sees the pace of the game, you can do that. But, yeah, in a one-off championship final, it's safety first, and he didn't do that, did he?
They could have put in a Def Leppard drummer, Steve Clarke, and they would have done better. And he's got one arm. He's got one arm.
In the,
James.
Is that his name?
Steve Clarke, it is, yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
No, no, in fairness, the goal he conceded was more of an issue with his feet. But you get the point.
It's a good analogy. And he did make a couple of good saves later. He's a very scrappy-looking keeper. I've always said he looks like an outfield player in a goalkeeper's jersey.
Yeah.
But he seems to get the job done. And he did make a couple of big saves later on. And that's what I did enjoy the final because I actually like watching college sports sometimes more than professional sports. I like watching American college football because the kids make mistakes, and I enjoy that. I like the unpredictability. Again, it wasn't a high-quality final necessarily, fantastic finishes and great goals and everything, but I think most people who watched it enjoyed it right to the end anyway.
And Portland, I mean, 11 losses this year. They're still a very good team regular season, but it just shows, you know, what MLS, just get into the show. And really, as we see every single year, that the so-called favorites don't always, you know, go all the way. I think it makes for a very exciting lead in that parity. You don't see in too many leagues around the world.
No, and NFL has always tried to pride itself on being a league of parity, and I think that's happening there too. But and other sports, I think, try to replicate that a bit. There's no more parity than there is in Major League Soccer because of the salary structure and the cap and everything else. But I think that's good, too. It means that every team generally is in it till the end, whether it's a playoff position that's on the line or, hosting the cup final, as we saw here. But you have to give credit to the two teams, too. They did come in as two of the hotter teams right at the end. And I think Portland and Columbus were, you know, right near the top three or four, if I'm not mistaken, by year's end anyway. So they came good at the right time. And also credit again to Caleb Porter, what he did with his team in terms of changing their formation and the importance of Darlington Nagbe in that side. And when you look at their squads, 11v11, there weren't a lot of areas of softness on either side.
And it's a good point you raise about Portland, because down the stretch, they were the hottest team in the league, unbeaten in, you know, the win over Columbus made it unbeaten in 9. So there was no question that they were the best team down the stretch.
Yeah. And so, you know, you can talk about the playoff format and whether North American sports or soccer in particular obviously should have a playoff format, or whether it should just be like in many countries around the world where the more important thing is, in this case, the supporter shield, winning the league championship. But I love having playoffs. I think it was a great playoff run for all the teams. More excitement, close games, fantastic finishes. I wouldn't want to change that in any way.
Now, Paul, MLS has changed some rules. There's more money being injected into the league, $37 million over the next 2 years. Basically, each team will have $800,000 more a year to spend. It's a bit more complicated than that. I won't ask you to explain targeted allocation money just yet. But when we look at, you know, the investment coming in, what that means to clubs and the Canadian teams, look at Vancouver, who obviously, once again, were a very good team this year, probably the best team in Canada. Montreal, a late-season brilliant performance, and obviously the Drogba factor, a good team, maybe to get better next year. And TFC, maybe, you know, front-ended, front-loaded, but still, a team with potential. With the extra money coming in, which of those three teams do you think is set to benefit the most?
Very good question. I mean, you would think it might be Vancouver, and that, as you say, most of the money is loaded into Toronto on their three DPs. The TAM money, the allocation money, isn't going to really pay down any of those salaries to make any of them non-DPs. I think that might be able to happen in Vancouver, maybe with a Matias Laba, which would free up space for another DP. Like you said there, James, it is very complicated how it works, but in saying that the teams have another 800K each opens up the room to bring in better players. I think that's the bottom line of what they're trying to achieve here. And I think they've been successful with that, with designated players. Maybe not from the beginning of when they did it several years ago, you know, when it was basically constructed to bring in David Beckham. But if you look at it now, you're bringing in some quality players that people may have not even heard of before. Obviously, Sebastian Giovinco is the first and foremost. hardcore followers of Serie A and the Italian team, of course, know about Sebastian Giovinco, but a young player in his prime coming in, not just an old name that people have seen play in World Cups. And, you know, to have other young players who come in the instance of the Whitecaps, and Octavio Rivero is a good example, or Pedro Morales perhaps, but you're going to get better players coming in that are in their prime, I think, rather than just the, you know, some of the older DP players that you're paying the big bucks for.
I mean, in terms of Toronto, they can't buy any of their three DPs down because $800,000 would barely make a dent in their salaries.
Right.
But it could help them possibly go after that, you know, stud center back that they seem to have been missing. I think the common complaint I hear amongst the TFC fan base is where is our Kendall Wastener, or where is our Laurent Simon? So possibly this, I mean, obviously you have to identify and scout the correct players and get that right, but this new extra target allocation money would certainly open the door for Toronto to go out and get such a player.
Yeah, and I think Kendall Waston's probably the better example of the two you mentioned there, John. Laurent Simon on a little bit higher ticket than Waston,
right.
But Waston's the perfect example of a player who probably goes up to 250, 300 grand now in the Defender of the Year conversation, and someone that Toronto FC would like to get to solidify that back line. You know, they did spend a lot of money on Ahmed Kantari, so
oh, yeah.
There was some money available there. But as you said, John, it's really, I think, less about the money in that situation, probably more about getting the player right, getting the scouting right. And that's the biggest challenge for Toronto FC right now, is to do the type of work that some of the other teams have done to find these uncovered gems.
Dolly, with your work with the Canadian national team, how anxious are you to see the player quotas relieved regarding Canada, Canadian players in MLS? Is it going to happen soon? We keep hearing hints that it might this year coming up, but we keep hearing that.
It's hugely important, and yeah, it does make us anxious, and we want to see that happen quickly because you've got players, and let me use an Adam Strath maybe as the perfect example. And true, he was in Vancouver, and maybe later developing, but he's done very well now in Scandinavia where he's playing. And he's the type of player that perhaps an American team in MLS wouldn't want to take a chance on, young player, not entirely proven yet, but one that if he was an American, they certainly would take a chance on. You know, Don Garber has said over the years that it's a U.S. workforce rule or labor law or whatever it is, and it just seems clear now that that's not the truth. And, you know, funny enough, something that Terry Dunfield tweeted I actually thought wasn't a bad shout. It's not as if perhaps you have to make all Canadians exactly the same. Let's take one stepping stone, maybe have a cap of two or three or something like that, but just make it so that a team that might be considering bringing a Canadian into their U.S.-based franchise wouldn't have to worry about him taking up an international spot. It's as simple as that. Maybe just one or two on each team, and I think that would open up a home for 10, 20 more players.
But I mean, this whole labor law nonsense. I mean, if that's the case, then you know, how are they allowed to have a cap, right? I mean, it's just it's nonsense. So yeah, I agree with you. Be honest. Be honest. And there's three Canadian teams now. They want to expand to 28 teams as well in the next 10 years or so or whenever, and that I would think would involve another Canadian team as well, at least. So I guess there is change on the horizon. The money's coming in, although the TV numbers weren't great for the final.
Boy.
And with a new TV deal up, I think, after this season, that might be very revealing, shall we say.
You know, the TV numbers for me, too, and I understand people saying, how can you go up against NFL on a Sunday? But then you've got the college football on the Saturday. And in Canada, too, we'd have Hockey Night in Canada at that time, wouldn't we? And then on a Friday, it's high school football, and this, that, and the other. There's always a reason. I would have thought that hardcore soccer fans, and I know you're trying to appeal to more than just that, would still, who prefer watching soccer, would still find a way to watch the MLS Cup final. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Columbus in particular, and Portland too for that matter, small market teams, aren't huge draws. I think a game in Portland in front of the Timbers Army there in that atmosphere against New York Red Bulls, for instance, would draw a much, much higher crowd or viewing audience. But it is worrying, and I wonder if it's just a regional league, and we have to kind of accept that Toronto fans or Vancouver fans or Montreal fans or fans in any other cities in MLS like to support their own team. They love the atmosphere of going to the stadium. They like watching their team when they play away from home on television. but they're not really bothered about two neutral teams, two teams that they haven't really invested in. Mm-hmm. I think obviously over time we might see more interest, as you do with other major North American league sports, but I think that's still something that's down the road.
100% right, 100% right. It is very much a regionalized sport still in this country, and you know, I think it's 87,000 people watched it in Canada over Sunday, and you know, look at the MLS numbers for TFC and for Vancouver and Montreal. Not far off, right?
Yeah.
In fact, higher in many regards than that. But I grew up watching European Cup finals on a Wednesday night my entire childhood. It only changed the weekends in recent years, in fact. So you can have a big game midweek and it still feels like a big deal to me. So I agree. I think maybe it's time to consider moving it outside the NFL, the college football ranks, and give it its own day. Wednesday night, for example, and go for there. Dolly, as always, mate, thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking to you throughout the season. I'm sure with all the news breaking between now and the start of the new campaign, we'll have you on again very soon. Cheers, mate.
Okay, good talking to you, fellas. Take care.
Cheers, Paul.
That's Paul Dolan, at Dolly the Goalie on Twitter. And this new injection of funds, JMO, I think is very exciting.
Yeah.
If it can be spent in the right way, obviously. But you can see essentially another DP coming in, a lower range DP coming in for that kind of money.
Yeah.
Or two players at 400. Pretty good.
Possibly, yeah.
You know what I mean? You can definitely help your depth of your team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way I think of it is you're almost adding like a fourth DP, because there are some designated players in the league who are making, you know, above the cap, maximum cap, at but below $1 million. So this allows you to bring in one and possibly two such players per year. So yeah, I think it improves the sort of middle to upper portion part of the roster. And I think that'll just sort of strengthen team depth all across the board. And it'll be interesting to see how certain teams use it. Of course, you can trade it as well. And yet the important point is you have to use it by 2017. Otherwise, it goes back to the league. So teams are going to have to use it either in terms of spending it on the players or trading it as a commodity. So I'm really interested to see how a lot of teams will use this over the next 2 years.
You're working on a piece on the website regarding TFC.
Yeah,
because I talked to Tim Bezbachenko recently.
Yeah, I talked to Tim Bezbachenko this not too long before we came on air, and just got his take on targeted allocation and how he plans to use it and some strategies. So pretty interesting. He had a pretty interesting take on it. He sees it as, while it's certainly a useful tool, it's just one of the many tools that, you know, GMs are going to have to use. So it's not the cure-all, be-all, and end-all, but you have to use it in conjunction with, you know, how you go about using taking the plunge in the reentry draft or in the waiver draft or in the college draft, and what you do in those sort of with those other mechanisms will affect what you do with the targeted allocation. So it's very strategic from what he was saying. Mm-hmm. So that story will be up later today on Sportsnet. I'd say if you want to hear what Tim Bezbachenko's take on all of this is.
Well, they've done it. They've managed it. They found out a way to make it even more complicated to follow MLS.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah, I know.
Brilliant.
It would just be, I mean, I'm longing for the day where there's no salary cap and play, and you can just spend whatever you want.
It's going to happen at some point.
You would think.
The thing is, can you trust the owners? That's the thing.
I think you can. And
wisely.
I think you can. And I think I think if you put it up to the owners, yeah, they would spend whatever they want, right? So, but obviously there's lessons to be learned from, you know, the North American Soccer League of old. So I understand that, you know, they want to sort of avoid what happened there. But I think eventually it is trending towards, you know, one day there not being a cap and teams being able to spend what they want. So we'll see.
Are we going to see Gary Monk on the sidelines of MLS next season, I wonder? Fired by Swansea this week.
I'd love it, but no, I mean,
just kidding. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah, what did you think?
I mean, I like Gary Monk a lot.
You can understand why they did.
Oh,
though,
no,
right?
100%.
Right.
In this day and age, one win in 11 games, you're a point up on the relegation zone. With the TV money coming in next year, you got to survive this year. So you got to try something. Whatever is wrong at that club, it's not working with Gary Monk. And I think it goes beyond Gary Monk.
Sure.
At Swansea, they're a team that have their transfer committee that doesn't, you know, so much involve the manager. He's given the players, now you coach them. And it worked last year, so obviously there's some personalities on that field that perhaps shouldn't be there. But I feel bad for him. You know, he's a young English manager who a year ago we were talking and he was doing so, so well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so rare to see that.
Seems like a decent guy, too.
Yeah, real good guy. Yeah, very down to earth and under the radar. Doesn't cause any waves. just goes about, and apparently is a workaholic, loves his job. He'll get another gig somewhere very soon, I'm sure.
Another Premier League
club? That might be a stretch. You never know, but I can see him going down a division.
Down the championship?
Yep. And he's the kind of guy that will do that, right? I mean, this is his dream job, right? He played at the club for 11 years.
Right.
And then got the gig. So I think he's smart enough that he'll do his homework and realize that maybe taking a step backwards will let him come back in a year or so, 2 years from now, you know, in a better position. But it's really sad, I thought, because he's one of the good guys in the game by all accounts. And this ruthless cutthroat industry we're in.
Yes. Now, who replaces him?
Do you know who the favorite is right now? Ready for this?
Brendan Rodgers?
No, it was Avram Grant.
Oh, really?
He's still around.
I don't get...
don't know. He's not a bad coach. He's not terrible. He seems like a decent guy when he's not doing awful things in bathhouses. remember that? Ooh, yeah. What a thought. But what has he done? Who does he know to keep getting these opportunities?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the fixation is of some chairman on hiring this guy. He's never really particularly impressed me.
No. But that's a favorite. Again, bookies, what do they know?
Right.
But yeah, Swansea's a big enough club, I think, and they got an owner that wants to win. So I'm sure they will find a decent replacement to Gary Monk. But too bad that Gary Monkinho is no longer in the Premier League.
Do you think Rodgers would go back?
It's a good question. I don't think he would. I think his ego is too great.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you see, maybe he would see it as a step down now, having coached
Liverpool.
I can
see him going overseas first, doing that, doing the old Gary Neville.
Oh, really?
I mean, listen, if he's offered a great gig in the Premier League, I'm sure he'll take it.
Right.
I'm just not sure he will get offered that gig. I mean, obviously, he won't get a gig bigger than Liverpool, but he could take a step back and still get a big club, a good club. But I can see him. He's a pretty cultured guy, right? He's well read, he's well versed, and I think he'd probably enjoy some life in the continent.
Well, go
back to Swansea is a bit like saying, okay, well, I went away,
sure,
I failed, and now I'm going to return, right? So,
well, it would be interesting to see if he did go to that sort of international route, and if he went to a country like Spain or France or Germany or Italy. It'd be, I wouldn't be the worst move in the world, depending on the club that he goes with, obviously.
Yeah. Well, when Rafa gets fired, right, by Real Madrid.
Yeah, well, I can't see him coaching Real Madrid. Maybe he'll go to Valencia. I mean, you know.
He does coach attacking football.
Yeah.
Right?
And not the best start for Neville yesterday.
First game, 2-0 loss to Lyon.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
You can't hold that against Gary.
Yes, we can.
Well.
Damn right we can. It's Gary Neville. Yeah. I love Gary Neville, actually, now. I used to despise him. But you see him, every interview I see him in, he's excellent.
Great interview.
He's excellent, yeah.
Well, he was asked about in the post-match conference, because the joke was, you know, what if you get drawn with Man United in the Europa League?
Yeah.
And he was just like, I'm worried about Sunday. And I forget who their opponent is in La Liga on Sunday, but he's just like, can we talk about that? I don't care about, like, Man United, so.
He was interviewed by a kid at some charity thing last week, and they had the interview on TV. The kid was probably like 9 years old. It was actually a really good interview, and he was outstanding in it.
In English? In Spain? In England.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was just outstanding, and it was very well done, and the kid did a great job as well, but his answers were thoughtful. Mm. They weren't in the least bit condescending to the kid. They were good answers to good questions. So I quite enjoyed that. Check it out on just Google it, Gary Neville kid interview. I'm sure you'll find it. Well, let's move on now from all that nonsense, Sam. We're joined by the man himself, the legend, Bobby the Brains McMahon. Bobby, let me ask you quickly, Gary Monk, Real Madrid, makes sense, doesn't it?
How long ago was it, James, we were talking about Gary Monk being the next great English manager?
It was about 3 months ago.
I was counting in weeks, actually. I was always thinking about it in days. But it's just a pattern, isn't it? I guess we just get carried away.
Yeah.
And, you know, good start to the season and everything looks lovely. And then it all kind of comes tumbling down, whether it's a case of they start to believe their own newspaper headlines, or whether it's really just this old regress to the norm kind of piece. But it's kind of disappointing, because at Swansea, they've still got potential. They still play some pretty good football. Mm-hmm. They've got a squad that shouldn't be going through the troubles that it goes through. So let's see what's up next. And maybe, you know, Gary Monk, maybe in a few years from now, we'll be looking back on a Gary Monk learning kind of experience. It's one of the things I found really interesting. I think it was Gabriel Mercotti some years ago. He did a comparison of how managers were treated, particularly in Spain, but to some extent in Italy as well. and how basically in the UK we kind of disparage managers that have been fired a number of times, while generally in Spain and Italy that's not looked upon as a negative thing. And they actually in some cases look as a positive thing, because they consider that if the manager is learning, it's actually getting a more experienced candidate. So it's maybe in Gary Monk's case, maybe it'll just be first big experience for him, and maybe he will go on to greater things.
Hey, maybe he's going to, on the gardening leave like Italian managers, and he'll be back at Swansea by March or something, you know? It's possible.
Yeah, if it was Palermo, he'd have
another, oh, definitely.
He'd have another two appointments between now and February.
Yes.
Hugh Jenkins is not quite like Zamperini, but maybe not far off, actually, now I think about it. Champions League this week, Bobby. Manchester United, well, they lost to Wolfsburg. They're out. Is patience key with Louis van Gaal, or is he just lost it completely?
Who's it once said that you get to a stage when managers only have bad decisions left in them, and maybe we're approaching that with Louis van Gaal. I just read an article by Jamie Jackson in The Guardian, and I'm reading about the Manchester United have failed in Europe because the Premier League will not institute Friday night games.
That's the reason.
I'm reading it and I'm going,
what does that mean?
Oh, crap.
So, but like, they won in the past with no Friday night games.
Exactly. Like, the excuses are getting pulled out all over the place. I think best case scenario is we get to 2:17 and Louis fades to black, fades into the distance and survives until 2:17. But there's a lot of spin doctoring going on at the moment. And the one thing that I find, I think if you look at Van Gaal's career, and there's a bit of a... Wenger's got this kind of same sort of aura about him as well, or attitude about him, and perhaps Mourinho to some extent as well. The more the critics say he's doing something wrong, the more he's intent on proving them that they're wrong and he's right in the first place.
Yeah.
So he tends to kind of double down on bad decisions, I think.
But and I've heard reports this week from Old Trafford, and they're saying that we're not interested in free agent to be Pep Guardiola. We're sticking with LVG. Now, I'm not disparaging LVG, you know, what he's done. He might well be the solution still, but how can you dismiss the chance of signing a Pep Guardiola? Because you're keeping faith with this? You can't, can you?
No, I think, you know, in with so many clubs, spin doctoring, the story has become one of the main objectives, and I think that was all about spin doctoring. It's kind of getting out in front of it, saying, well, City have got a chance of getting Guardiola. At some point, somebody's going to say, well, why didn't Manchester United go after him? So maybe we'll get out in front and we'll convince all these gullible suckers out there that we actually aren't interested in him. When, you know, it's kind of, you know, the guy that goes, I would never go out with her after she turns you down, right? It's kind of warped, but it makes for decent headlines, and it'll convince some of the faithful that they weren't interested in Guardiola. When, as you point out, James, quite rightly, you'd have to be insane not to be interested if he was available.
Bobby, are we not giving enough credit here to Wolfsburg and PSV? Because I think a lot of the talk about, you know, Man United bowing out has been, well, what's wrong with them, and looking as to reasons why as to they bowed out in the first round. But I thought Wolfsburg and PSV played Man United very tough in the group, and they were fully deserving to go through.
Yeah, and notwithstanding that as well, John, let's go back just a couple of years when Manchester United went out, I think it was to Basel.
Right.
And remember, they went out to Athletic Bilbao, and I think in the Europa League as well, in kind of spectacular circumstances, as much as Bilbao kind of played them off the park. So you've got that piece. Like Wolfsburg, Draxler was magnificent.
Yeah.
You're watching what he's pulling off there, and you're going, this is some player here, 22. You know, maybe in a few couple of years' time, we'll be talking about Draxler being one of the great players in Europe if he can keep up this kind of progress. We've been talking about Draxler for a long time because I think he made his debut as maybe a 16 or 17 year old. So he seems to have been around a long time. But that showing and that performance was absolutely spectacular. Eindhoven, you're right, they did play Manchester United well. But I think when it comes back to our expectations around Manchester United and the aura that's been built up over a quarter of a century under Sir Alex Ferguson and the money they have to spend, the bottom line is they should be... That wasn't a difficult section. You look at the... In terms of particularly the Dutch clubs, the performance of the Dutch clubs have not been particularly good in Europe for some time now, probably around about a decade. You maybe have to go back to maybe 2006, 2007 for some really decent Dutch performances in Europe. So there's no great expectation there. You look at CSKA, and as many times as they make it to the Champions League group stage, very, very rarely have they ever made it any further than that. And Wolfsburg, you know, admittedly, kind of emerging as a force again in Europe. They had that 1 year round about 2008, 2009 or whatever it was when they won the league. But then they kind of dropped back. Now they're kind of re-establishing themselves. But the bottom line to it is, no matter how good Wolfsburg and PSV played, we'll still look at it through the lens of Manchester United failure.
Yeah, I think it's great though. I mean, listen, Wolfsburg have to sell De Bruyne to an English team last year, right? PSV have to sell Depay to United last year. Yeah, I mean, listen, Wolfsburg has spent a lot of money in previous years, we know that, but I think it looks good on those teams for sure. Chelsea, they look good. It seems like there's two different teams this year for Chelsea, and we see it now and again, don't we? We see a European team who play a certain way with a certain swagger, and then we see their domestic team who are just, you know, a shadow of that. Do you agree, and what is the reason, Bobby? You solve it for us.
if I could solve that one, James. It's almost like it's almost back to the old something you used to see in the old European Cup quite a bit, was teams that had won the championship of the domestic title, and then the next year they'd kind of get so focused on European Cup that their domestic performances would tail off, but they'd actually, you know, either through design or by happen chance, they'd kind of be quite good in Europe and go quite deep into Europe. There's quite a pattern of that. It kind of disappeared with the Champions League, I think, because of the group stage and all the rest and the real dominance of some of these big money clubs. But I think with Chelsea, I'm guessing anyway, that when they come up against European opposition, they're still very much, even though they're struggling domestically, there's probably still very much an aura of Chelsea and of Mourinho that perhaps makes them, gives them a little bit more confidence and perhaps intimidates these teams a little bit more. I think you get to a stage when in domestic competition, I think we've seen it this year, we saw it with Manchester United after Ferguson went, and we've seen it with other teams. It's almost like these teams spell blood in the water, and suddenly one defeat becomes two defeats, becomes three defeats, because the glamour of these clubs and the intimidation that they carry begins to disappear, and clubs, when they face them, just feel a lot more confident. They feel like it's their turn to get, to beat up on them. So, you know, Chelsea have turned so many corners, but they never really seem to, certainly in domestic competition this year, put together that sort of series of results that really, really make you confident that the bad times are beyond and they're back to what we'd think they'd be. Every time they put in a good performance, there's still a doubt in the back of their mind that they can put it together over 3, 4, 5 games. And now they've left themselves in such a position that they've got to come, they've got to average, what is it about? I think they've got to have about the equivalent of a 100-point season over the remainder of the season if they want to average 2 points. And usually about 2 points is enough to get into the top four. They've just left themselves such a massive hole that maybe their best route back to the Champions Cup next year is actually just winning the Champions League this year.
Juventus entered match day six top of the group, needing just a draw away to Sevilla to win the group and go through to the next round as a group winners. Obviously lost in Spain, and then Man City had that incredible comeback against Mönchengladbach to win the group, bumping Juventus down to second. How much do you think the Italians are going to regret that?
All comes down to the draw, doesn't it, John?
Yeah.
You know, you look at the draw, and certainly you finish second in the section. It makes it, the odds certainly skew much more strongly towards a tougher draw when you've got, particularly when you come out a section with Manchester City, it means you're not taking out some of the big guys. The one benefit, if you kind of look at Arsenal, although they made, you know, they made a dog's breakfast eventually qualifying, but you look at Arsenal's situation, the one good thing going for them is they can't draw Bayern Munich in the last 16 at least.
Right.
Because they were in that group. In the last 16.
Yeah.
You haven't got that dynamic with Juventus at the moment. So, you know, you might get a bit of luck and they might draw one of the weaker, you know, they might draw a Zenit, and it doesn't look too bad at that stage. But you've got to think that the odds are going to be they're going to take on one of the top dogs. But there again, we're talking about Juventus. We're talking about a team that went to the Champions League final last year. They've struggled to build that confidence and build that kind of run of form. And maybe I tend to think this is rather a case of a setback than Juventus losing their way, as they seem to do at the beginning of the season. So let's wait and see what the draw comes up with on Monday, and we'll be able to make a call of whether Juventus finishing second was good or bad.
Very quickly, we were spoken the last few weeks about Ronaldo and how maybe we're seeing the first signs of a slight decline. Still a wonderful, wonderful player, but not quite what he was 2 years ago. And then he scores 4 goals for Real Madrid this week. What are your thoughts? I mean, we know Neymar has really risen this season to get, if not nose and nose of Messi and Ronaldo, very, very close. But do you think, despite this week's performance, we are beginning to see the beginning of the end, perhaps, of Ronaldo as the best player alongside Messi?
Yeah, it's inevitable. It happens to every player. The degree of the decline varies from player to player, and the ability to reinvent themselves, I think, you know, Ryan Giggs is probably the outstanding example of somebody that kind of reinvented themselves in their 30s. From a player that would skip past defenders to somebody that would sort of be the equivalent of unpicking a lock in terms of his discipline defensively, but also his ability to pick out the right pass at the right time and control the tempo of the game. So I've got a sense that Ronaldo will be kind of reinventing himself the way that Ryan Giggs did. But the bottom line here is Ronaldo and Messi have been so far ahead of everybody else over the last 6 or 7 years that when you come up against a team with the quality of Malmo, the bottom line is there's still a lot of... Ronaldo is still so far ahead. He's always liable to fill the net with goals against a team like Malmo. The problem you start seeing, I think, as players begin to decline is they just can't do it in the big matches. And that, I think, is really when we know that the game is up, when they stop producing at that level.
So, Bobby, the draw is going to be on Monday for the round of 16. If you're one of those second-place teams, who do you want to avoid drawing? I mean, who do you see as maybe one or two of the favorites going forward?
You got to look at Barcelona. That's probably the least informed comment you're ever going to get. Everybody would pick them.
Sure.
Real Madrid, I believe they haven't even been behind in any group games so far. So they're one you would... not want to play. Bayern Munich, obviously. That's a big three. The Champions League has really evolved into this big three over the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. Teams that are pretty consistently at that level. Atletico Madrid, I think you'd be very wary of, in as much as Diego Simeone in charge, still a rugged, committed kind of side that could cause you problems. But I would suggest on the other side of it, if you're a European team, and looking at potentially English opposition, Man City are still in a bit of a conundrum. But as they have shown, and they do show now and again, when they do really play, they've got, they are a force to be reckoned with. I don't believe that we'll be talking at the end of the season about Manchester City being the winner of the Champions League. But I think there's a certain amount of, I think there's a lot of clubs who prefer to avoid Manchester City in the quarterfinal stage than last 16 rather than play them.
At least the Man City team with Vincent Kompany, not the Man City team without Vincent Kompany. It seems very different teams.
Yeah.
Bobby, I really enjoyed this as always, mate. Enjoy the games this weekend, and we will chat to you real soon.
Thanks very much, guys.
That is Bobby McMahon at Bobby Soccerep is his address on Twitter. Follow him; he is a must. Follow. Busy weekend across the networks. On Saturday, we have Man City, Swansea, Crystal Palace, Southampton, Bayern Munich, Ingolstadt. Sunday, we have Liverpool against West Brom, Spurs against Newcastle. So, as always, a weekend full of Premier League action. What's happening on the website, JMO? The usual?
Yeah, the usual. We're going to have a full preview of the German and English League weekends coming up, and as I mentioned earlier, I'll have that story on Tim Bezbachenko going up later today. We're gonna have your video report, your weekly video report on the EPL. So
this week it's 5 questions that need to be asked this weekend that won't be answered.
There you go. So lots of good stuff.
All right, we'll be back, myself with Thomas Dobby and Brendan Dunlop, on Monday, assuming we're all alive this Monday. The voice just about held up. Just
yeah.
about. There were times where I was wondering, it was wavering.
Yes.
But I think we got through it. Hope you enjoyed that, everyone. We'll chat to you later. See ya.